Welcome to this deep dive. In this lesson, we're exploring digital tools for organization and efficiency. If you've watched the overview, this will build on that. If not, you'll still be able to follow along. Now let's go further by exploring practical examples, future workplace relevance, responsible use, and how you can build confidence with this skill.
Absolutely.
So to really set the stakes for you listening today, I want you to imagine a pretty common scenario. You know, you are in this high-pressure video call.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there.
Right. Maybe it's a new client or senior management. And you're sharing your screen, and they ask to see the latest budget breakdown.
The dreaded request.
Yeah. So you minimize your presentation, and there it is. Your computer desktop is just an absolute digital graveyard.
Just files everywhere.
Exactly. It's covered in dozens of icons with names like Document 1 or Budget V2. And my personal favorite, actually Final Use This In.
Oh, yes. The classic.
So you click one, and it's the wrong version. Your heart rate immediately spikes.
Of course it does.
You start scrambling through your downloads folder. The silence on the call just stretches out. And that specific, visceral panic, that hot flash of embarrassment, that is exactly what we are dismantling today.
I love that you started with that because that physical reaction is incredibly telling. The stress you feel in that scenario, it isn't just a mild annoyance, you know. It is a profound biological response to an environment out of control.
Really? Biological?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We often treat digital clutter differently than physical clutter, mostly because, well, it doesn't take up literal square footage in our homes, but the neurological toll it takes on your brain is practically identical.
Wow.
Yeah. So when your digital environment is chaotic, you aren't just losing files. You are actively degrading your cognitive capacity.
Man, let's dig into that neurology for a second, because I think a lot of people listening, and definitely myself included, sometimes brush off being disorganized as just this quirky character trait.
Right. Like a badge of honor almost.
Yeah. Yeah. We say, oh, I have a messy desktop, but I know where everything is. It's organized chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But the research suggests that organized chaos is basically a biological myth, isn't it?
It completely is.
Yeah.
If we look at Daniel J. Levitin's work in The Organized Mind from 2014, he breaks down exactly how the human brain processes information and physical space.
Okay, how so?
Well, evolution designed our brains to map physical environments. Your hippocampus is exceptional at remembering that, you know, the river is past the tree line.
Or that my keys are on the kitchen counter.
Exactly. It relies heavily on spatial memory. But the digital world, a glowing screen with infinitely nested abstract directories, it completely strips away those physical cues.
Because everything basically looks the same.
Right. When you rely on knowing where everything is in a messy digital space, you are forcing your brain's working memory to constantly map an invisible shifting landscape.
So you are essentially burning computational power just trying to render the environment before you even open the file to do the actual work.
Precisely. In cognitive science, this ties into cognitive load theory. Your working memory can really only hold a very limited number of items at once, usually around 4 to 7.
That's it. Just 4 to 6.
4 to 7. So if 3 of those slots are occupied by the background stress of remembering where you saved the project brief and like what arbitrary acronym you used to name it last Tuesday.
Your processing speed for deep work just plummets.
Exactly. Levitin points out that navigating unstructured data literally spikes our cortisol levels.
Wait. Literally spikes it, like a stress response.
Oh, yeah. The visual noise of a chaotic desktop triggers a low-grade fight-or-flight response because the brain registers it as an unresolved problem.
Okay, let's unpack this. Isn't workflow management just a corporate buzzword for making a to-do list?
I get that question a lot, and it's a great point, but the distinction is massive. To really understand why, we can turn to David Allen's foundational 2001 work, Getting Things Done.
Oh, the GTD method.
Yes, exactly. Allen explains why a basic to-do list often fails us. A to-do list is usually just a collection of open loops. It's a list of unclarified demands on your time.
Like writing down taxes or fix car.
Right. Those aren't tasks. Those are complex projects disguised as tasks. When you look at a list of vague demands, your brain immediately recognizes the ambiguity. It anticipates all the cognitive heavy lifting required to figure out the very first step.
And then naturally resorts to procrastination.
Bingo! Because taxes isn't an action.
Right. I can't just sit down and do taxes.
Oh,
I have to find my W-2, log into a portal, call my accountant. So when I look at the word taxes on a list, I feel totally overwhelmed, and I just go check my email instead.
Exactly. The Zeigarnik effect in psychology dictates that our brains obsess over uncompleted, unclarified tasks. it creates this constant background hum of anxiety.
So how does a workflow fix that?
Well, a true workflow, as defined by Alan, is the holistic system that captures those vague ideas, clarifies exactly what the next physical action is, and organizes it into a trusted system. Think of it like this. A workflow is the entire factory assembly line. The task management tool is simply the conveyor belt moving a highly specific, actionable item to the person who needs to do it at the exact moment they need to do it.
Okay, that makes sense. But let me push back on this a little bit, specifically regarding how we find things. We are living in the era of incredibly powerful universal search engines.
Yeah.
Like I have Spotlight on my Mac, Windows has a universal search bar, cloud drives have AI-assisted queries. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to spend time building a meticulous Dewey Decimal style hierarchy of folders if I can just hit Command Space, type a keyword, and find what I need in half a second?
It's tempting, right?
Yeah. Isn't an elaborate folder system kind of a relic of the Windows 95 era?
That is honestly the most common argument against digital organization today.
Yeah.
And it sounds perfectly logical until you look at the mechanics of human memory. The fundamental difference between using a search bar and using a structured folder system is the difference between recall and recognition.
Okay, break that down for me. Recall versus recognition.
So using a search bar relies entirely on recall. It requires your brain to spontaneously generate a specific memory from the past. You have to remember the exact keyword, the specific phrasing, or, you know, the exact date you created the file.
Which is hard to do under pressure.
Exactly. Recall is cognitively expensive. Recognition, on the other hand, is cognitively cheap. When you open a clearly labeled folder for 2026 marketing campaigns, and inside you see a folder for Q3 social media, you don't have to remember anything.
You just recognize the path.
Right. You are following a logical breadcrumb trail.
So relying on search means I have to trust that my future self will be able to read my present self's mind. And knowing my future self, that is a terrible gamble.
It really is.
I mean, I might name a file Project Notes today.
Yeah.
The context is fresh. I know exactly what project I'm working on. But 6 months from now, I will have 50 different documents called Project Notes.
And the universal search bar is just going to hand you a pile of identical names. And that is exactly where the search strategy completely collapses at scale. Search is a great supplemental tool, sure, but it cannot be your structural foundation. The goal is to build an environment that requires zero active memory to navigate.
Which connects to Tiago Forte's stuff, right?
Yes. This concept is heavily explored in Tiago Forte's Building a Second Brain from 2022. The entire philosophy is built on the realization that your biological brain is designed for having ideas, not for holding them.
I've always found that concept fascinating. The idea that we need to actively build an external architecture to hold our thoughts, so our internal architecture is free to actually think.
It fundamentally changes how you approach your computer, your digital systems, your file architecture, your note-taking apps, your task managers. They should act as a reliable external extension of your mind.
Offloading the heavy lifting.
Exactly. When you offload the structural heavy lifting to an external system, you eliminate the friction of starting. You don't have to spend the first 20 minutes of your workday playing digital detective.
You're just removing the obstacles between you and the work. That's huge.
Yeah.
But I want to shift gears here. Everything we've talked about so far, loading cortisol, reducing cognitive load, Tiago Forte's second brain, it's deeply focused on the individual.
You're right, true.
It's all about personal productivity. But the reality is, especially for anyone stepping into a modern career or working on university projects, you are rarely operating in total isolation. Let's talk about what happens when these personal systems collide with other people.
Oh, this is where the stakes escalate dramatically. The leap from personal productivity to collaborative organization is where digital tools either become a massive force multiplier or a complete liability.
Liability is a strong word, but yeah, it fits.
It really does. Yep. When we look at real-world case studies of modern project coordination, the difference between a high-performing team and a failing team rarely comes down to raw talent. It almost always comes down to system architecture.
Right.
Platforms like Google Drive, Microsoft OneDrive, and Trello, they are not just digital filing cabinets. They are kinetic shared environments.
You know, I think a really accurate way to visualize a shared cloud drive is to look at a commercial restaurant kitchen during the Friday night dinner rush.
Oh, I like that.
Right. It is a highly kinetic, fast-paced environment. Every cook on the line needs to know exactly where the salt is, where the prepped vegetables are, and what tickets are coming up next. The whole system relies entirely on predictability.
That is a perfect analogy. The concept of mise en place, having everything in its specific place before you start cooking, is exactly what digital collaboration requires.
Right, and if the prep cook decides to get creative and puts the salt in an unmarked plastic container or, like, hides the chef's knife in their personal apron because that's just how they like to organize, the entire dinner service grinds to a halt.
Chaos.
The executive chef can't cook, the food gets cold.
And in the corporate world, that prep cook is the team member who refuses to use the shared project management software.
Yeah. Here's where it gets really interesting. What happens when one person in the group refuses to use the system?
Well, it's a disaster. It's the person who keeps their updates in a private local notebook or emails random misnamed Word documents while everyone else is trying to collaborate live in the cloud.
They break the whole chain.
Exactly. In a digitally enabled team, personal disorganization doesn't just hurt the individual. It creates a systemic bottleneck. If you are the missing link in that assembly line, you are effectively blinding the rest of the team to your progress.
Which brings up a really important conversation about digital etiquette and what we might call the ethics of shared space. Mm-hmm. Because if we are operating in a collaborative environment, my mess immediately becomes your mess.
It fundamentally reframes how we view organization. It stops being about your personal preference for neatness and starts being a matter of professional courtesy.
Wow, professional courtesy. I like that phrasing.
Yeah. What does responsible use mean in the context of digital workflows? It means acknowledging that your outputs are someone else's inputs.
So leaving a disorganized, naming convention-free mess in a shared cloud folder is really no different than leaving dirty, crusty dishes in the communal office sink.
Yes.
It forces your colleagues to clean up after you before they can actually do their own jobs. It just shows a lack of respect for their time.
It creates a massive amount of invisible labor for your peers. When you strictly adhere to a naming convention, you know, including the date, the project code, the version number, you are communicating reliability.
You're being a good team player.
Exactly. If a team member goes into the shared drive at 11:00 p.m. to pull data for a morning presentation, they need to trust that the data is the latest version. Responsible use means maintaining the structural integrity of the system so others aren't left guessing.
But let me play devil's advocate for a second regarding task management software in the workplace.
Okay, go for it.
From the employee's perspective, having a shared dashboard where management can see every single task you check off every hour of the day,
mm-hmm.
It can feel heavily intrusive. It can easily feel like surveillance or micromanagement digitized.
That is a very valid concern. And honestly, it happens often when leadership misunderstands the purpose of the tool.
So how should they be using it?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, task management tools shouldn't be viewed as surveillance, but rather as tools for transparency, trust, and accountability.
Okay, explain that a bit more.
When implemented responsibly, a transparent task management system actually eliminates micromanagement. Think about why a manager hovers or constantly sends those just checking in messages.
Because they're stressed out.
Right. They do it because they lack visibility and trust. They don't actually know what the status of the project is.
So the system replaces the need for the manager to constantly interrupt you.
Exactly. When everyone uses a shared board like Jira or Asana properly, the system provides ambient awareness. The manager can look at the dashboard, see that the task is in the review column, and completely leave you alone.
That sounds amazing, actually.
It is. Task management tools should never be viewed as employee trackers. They build a professional setting where your invisible hard work becomes visible and valued, and where everyone's collective progress is mapped out without the friction of endless status meetings.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The system protects your focus by answering questions before they even get asked.
Yeah, exactly.
So what does this all mean for someone listening right now who feels completely overwhelmed? How do they actually start? Because if their digital life is currently that chaotic pile of loose papers, how do they build a system without falling into the trap of spending a whole weekend over-engineering a complex setup only to completely abandon it by Wednesday?
That is the danger, isn't it? Avoiding system decay is the most critical part of this process. The reason people abandon their organizational systems is usually because they created something way too rigid and highly bureaucratic.
Like trying to use 50 different color-coded tags.
Right. They create a system that requires more energy to maintain than the energy it saves. The goal is to design a lightweight architecture based on four very functional pillars.
Okay, let's walk through those four pillars, keeping in mind that we want to avoid over-engineering.
The first pillar is your structural containers, your folders. But instead of just creating a folder for every minor thought, you establish a clear, broad hierarchy. Think of them as designated zones. You need a zone for active projects, a zone for long-term reference material, and an archive for things that are finished but might be needed next year.
So it's about defining the state of the work rather than just the topic, an active zone versus a storage zone.
Exactly. Keep it broad. The second pillar is your action spaces, your task lists. This cannot be a random notepad on your desk. You need one single trusted inbox where you capture every single action item the moment it enters your brain before you forget it.
Okay, a single inbox.
And crucially, as we learned from David Allen, you must translate those items into physical next actions before you schedule them.
Right, turning taxes into email account in the W-2.
You've got it.
What's the third pillar?
Temporal boundaries, your calendars. A calendar is not just a place to accept meeting invites. It is a strategic tool to defend your focus.
Oh, I love that. Defending your focus.
Yeah. When you map out your deadlines digitally, you should also be blocking out the time required to do the deep work. If it's not on the calendar, the time doesn't exist, and it will get eaten up by reactive tasks.
Oh, I do that. I use my calendar defensively all the time. If I don't block out 2 hours for writing, someone will inevitably schedule a brainstorming sink right in the middle of my most productive window.
It never fails.
Nope. And the fourth pillar.
Overarching context, your project categories. This is the glue that binds the other three together. You group your specific folders, your actionable tasks, and your calendar blocks by overarching projects.
Okay, how does that work in practice?
Well, this means when it's time to work on the Q3 launch, you aren't hunting for pieces across your entire computer.
Yeah.
Everything related to that specific outcome lives together conceptually.
And I think the key takeaway for anyone listening is that you don't have to perfectly implement all four of those pillars by tomorrow morning.
No, definitely not.
You have to find the rhythm that actually maps to how your brain works.
Yeah.
It requires a bit of trial and error. I mean, if you find yourself constantly avoiding your task manager, the tool isn't broken, your workflow is just too complicated.
Exactly. You have to approach your own workflow with curiosity rather than self-criticism. There is no single, perfect, universal way to organize. The goal is progress, not absolute perfection.
So just be patient with yourself.
Right. If your current system is failing, don't view it as a personal failure. View it as data. Ask yourself where the friction is happening. Are you losing files? Change your naming convention. Are you missing deadlines? Start aggressively blocking time on your calendar. Just start small.
Just clear one little corner of that messy commercial kitchen to start prep work today.
Exactly. By slowly implementing these architectures, you drastically reduce your daily cognitive load. You transform your digital tools from sources of anxiety into engines that drive meaningful, focused productivity.
And when you apply those personal systems to collaborative environments, you elevate your entire team's ability to execute smoothly.
Absolutely.
Which brings us to the cool reflection prompt from our deep dive today. Something for you to deeply consider as you step back to your own computer and look at your current setup.
Right. What digital systems can help me become more organized and efficient? Think about where your specific friction points are and how a structured external architecture might relieve that pressure.
As you adapt to new digital tools, we encourage you to stay curious, stay responsible, and stay future ready. Be sure to review the end of module study guide and complete the workbook activities.
Today's insights were informed by Daniel J. Levitin's The Organized Mind from 2014, David Allen's Getting Things Done from 2001, and Tiago Forte's Building a Second Brain from 2022.
Thank you for joining us.